This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Futuro.
Dear listener, today's episode is a continuation of a story we started telling last week. If you haven't listened to it, we really recommend that you go to our feed and look for Unsafe in Foster Care Part 1 and listen to it. This episode might be hard to listen to for some of you. It includes details about the death of two children.
Nobody really knows what it's like to be in the system, and everybody has different judgments of people who end up in the system. People think, oh, you have rights. Well, do you really? Do you really have rights?
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, part two of our story, Unsafe in Foster Care. This week, we continue with our investigation into the child welfare system in Los Angeles County, which is the biggest child protection service in the United States. We met Leah Garcia, a mother who called the police after her partner turned violent. Leah was looking for safety for herself and for her two children. Her calls to the police triggered the involvement of LA's Department of Children and Family Services, known as DCFS. Social workers concluded that Leah wasn't able to protect her children, and so her three-year-old daughter was placed with her birth father, but her five-month-old baby, Joseph, the son she had with her abusive partner, was placed with a foster care family. Leah struggled to see her baby boy weekly because he was placed in a foster home nearly 2 hours away from her. She worried about Joseph's well-being. And then, one day, she got a call from the police. Her son Joseph had died. Allegedly, the baby had accidentally been choked by the car seatbelt. Reporter Deepa Fernandez has been investigating Joseph's death for over a year. In her research, a lot of questions came up about how Joseph had been cared for by the foster care system and questions about his death. Then, in Joseph's autopsy report, Deepa found a disturbing fact. Another baby had died in the same foster home just 2 months before Joseph. Deepa Fernandez picks up the story from here.
After reading Joseph Chacon's autopsy report, I had questions about how he died. According to Joseph's foster mother, she took 19-month-old Joseph to Target at around 8:10 on the evening of January 24, 2020. She reported hearing him making noises in the back seat, so she turned around and drove home. A whole hour later, at 9:09 p.m., she called 911. Some details didn't make sense and even seemed to contradict each other. So I went by to visit someone I'd reported on some years ago when she was the chief and only child death investigator for LA County, Denise Bertone. Back in 2013, she gave me a tour.
This is where the autopsies are done. It's a large room. And you can see everybody's washing up now and cleaning the instruments for tomorrow.
Now I'm meeting Denise Bertone at her home. She no longer works investigating child deaths for the county.
Denise, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I've asked for her expert opinion on what happened to Joseph Chacon. And she wants me to understand clearly that
I don't work at the coroner's office anymore, so I don't have the backstory. I don't have access to the case notes. I only have the autopsy report, which is public record.
I I've also shown Bretonne the emergency medical technician report that I was able to get from when the paramedics showed up to the foster home at 9:18 p.m. She studied them both. Bretonne notes ligature marks on the right side of the neck from the seatbelt, but wonders if this could have caused him to choke to death. The buckle clasp, if it slid tightly up against his neck, might have caused breathing challenges, but that would have left a different kind of mark, Bretonne notes. There were no seatbelt buckle marks found on Joseph. Bretonne also has other questions about the foster mother's account to the police of how Joseph died.
She states that he is in a rear-facing car seat, but he's 19 months old. My question is, he's in a rear-facing car seat. He's 19 months old. His legs are going to be compressed against the back of the seat.
This is important to note because he was in an infant capsule type car seat, so he would not have had room to really slip down as his legs would have been pressing into the back of the seat.
So my question would be, the caretaker says she's driving and she hears there's a report of gurgling or gasping. She, in the interview with the coroner investigator, who does a very thorough job in talking to her, he did a really nice report. Now, what would be typical for a prudent caregiver would hear gasping or gurgling, and you'd pull the car over and be sure he's okay. And this caregiver does not pull the car over. She does not check on him, and she drives home. And there's a time lapse, a considerable time lapse.
The time lapse is important because one thing investigators try to figure out is when the child might have died. So remember, she calls 911 at 9:09 p.m. and at 9:18 p.m. paramedics arrive.
What we do notice is that the paramedics reported that his jaw was stiff. Rigor mortis is a stiffening of the muscles that happens after death. There's never been any study in children, nothing that's reliable, that says when rigor mortis starts in a child. But we do know that this was not a fresh death. This is not a death that had occurred within 10 or 15 minutes.
The autopsy notes that the child was last seen well at 8:30 p.m. When the paramedics get there in the minutes after the 911 call was made, they report Joseph to be, quote, cool and dry. Paramedics note the ligature marks on Joseph's neck.
But I do know from doing over 2,500 deaths in the county, and there was a good portion of those, as well as being an emergency room nurse, that if she heard that child gasping, drove home, paramedics are immediately called, that when that child gets to the emergency room, he will be floppy. He will be relaxed. He will be limp. He's pulseless. And this child, according to the paramedic, his jaw was stiff, and when the emergency room physician attempts to put the breathing tube in, the neck and the jaw are both stiff. This is supposed to have happened within 30 minutes to 60 minutes, and I would question that timeline.
Denise Bretonne had more questions too.
According to when the caregiver is interviewed by the coroner investigator, there's a report that at 5:40 in the evening, the child ate soup. And then at 7:30, he ate crackers. Now, there should be soup and crackers at that hour. There should still be something left in his stomach. But when Dr. Young does the autopsy report, he notes that the stomach is empty. Now, liquids can empty that quickly, and I don't know if the soup, you know, we don't know what kind of soup it was, but he did eat crackers at 7:30, and then he's essentially in cardiac arrest by 9:30, and his stomach is completely empty. So there could also be more questions asked about that.
Yet, despite all these questions, Joseph's mum, Leah Garcia, called me to tell me she finally heard the conclusion from the detective.
Hi, Deepa. It's me, Leah. I heard back from the detective, and she told me that Joseph's case with the doctor who's working on this case is saying it looks like an accident, and it has to do with the car seat, which doesn't make much sense to me. But that's what he said, that they're saying that it's an accident from the car seat.
Joseph's death was ruled an accident, and the case was closed. I made multiple calls to the detective on the case, but he never called me back. Yet key questions remained unanswered. Was Joseph strapped incorrectly in the car seat? If he was, the person who strapped him in wrong might be negligent. And if he was strapped in correctly, but the car seat was faulty and the straps choked Joseph, that car seat would be a danger to all children, and it would have been recalled. It hasn't been.
I am aware that this case was closed as an accident. I'm not comfortable with that. And the reason I'm not comfortable with that is because an accident is exactly that, an accident. But this is, she's aware this child is in distress and fails to help him. And the body shows there was a delay in seeking medical care for him. And to me, that is egregious neglect.
The delay in seeking treatment may be squarely the fault of the foster mother. But was the system neglectful as well? That was what I wanted to know. And here's the other thing we learned from reading the autopsy and requesting 911 calls made from the foster home. It turns out Joseph was not the first baby the foster mother called 911 about. Just 2 months before Joseph died, this happened.
911, what is the emergency?
Hi, yes, this is calling in because I have a three-month-old baby boy. He is a foster baby. He's not breathing.
This was November 16, 2019, just 2 months before Joseph died in this foster home. Here was another baby not breathing. The foster mother was caring for multiple children at the time. We don't know how many because DCFS cannot disclose this information to us. The only information we had on this baby was what the foster mother told the emergency dispatcher.
And how old is he, you said?
He's going to be 3 months on the 25th.
And how early was he born?
I believe 35 or 36 weeks. He was drug exposed, and I don't know what else he was exposed to.
The baby died. We requested the autopsy for three-month-old Draco Ford. I wanted to learn about him, and I wanted to find his mother, which I eventually did. Delasia Taylor is 24. She lives in Lancaster and is tall and thin. She has a deep sadness in her face. Tattooed real small on the side of her eye are the letters of Draco's name, dropping down like teardrops.
Draco was 3 months old when he passed. He was born August 21st, 2019. And he died 3 months later, November 17th or 18th, because I wasn't there. We had him for a month, and he was a happy baby.
I met this grieving mother right outside the Lancaster courthouse where her children were formally removed from her.
He was a premature baby, so I'm pretty sure he had problems a preemie had, so he needed extra care. And we gave him that care, me and the dad.
Delasia's attorney advised her not to speak specifically about the details of why her children were removed in the first place because she still has an open case with DCFS for her older child. According to public records, her children were removed due to a domestic violence incident and exposure to drugs in the home where the family lived with other people.
Did you ever get any offers or any help given to you by the social workers before they removed your children?
No, they didn't give me any services. They just told me to figure things out and get it done, basically. So that's just what I try to do.
And did you know what that meant? Did you know what to do?
I mean, like, not really, but I felt like I just had to figure it out. So I just tried to figure it out.
When her children were taken, her attorney asked that they be placed with Delasia's mother, the children's grandmother. The judge, hearing the case, denied the request. When Delasia was allowed to visit with Draco, it happened under DCFS supervision, and she could only see him 3 times a week for 3 hours each time.
And how did you find out that he had passed away?
My mom called me and told me that the hospital called her. Well, the police came to her house with a picture of the baby to identify him. And so she called me and told me.
It's still very hard for her to process what happened.
Do you feel like you got answers from anyone as to what happened? Like, what was the story you were told?
At first, I didn't really get an answer. And then later, I was told that he died of SIDS.
SIDS, or Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. It's sometimes also known as SUIDS, Sudden Unexplained Infant Death.
My mom asked one of the workers, and one of the workers had told her that he was asleep in his bed and that she came back like a few hours later and he was deceased or like unconscious, one or the other. But he was rushed to the hospital.
18 months later, this was all she knew, and she's deeply sad.
Coming up on Latino USA, we look into what DCFS did or didn't do after 2 children died in the same foster home. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hey, we're back. Before the break, we heard the analysis of former child death investigator Denise Bertone on the death of Joseph Chacon. Now she looks at what happened to Draco Ford, the other baby who died in the same foster home 2 months before Joseph. Reporter Deepa Fernandez picks the story up from here.
Former child death investigator Denise Bertone also reviewed Draco Ford's autopsy. According to the autopsy, he died of sudden unexplained infant death syndrome.
Now, the problem with using either of those terms is that the layperson, the detectives, DCFS workers even, when someone says just a SIDS, they think SIDS or SUIDS is some medical disease that hasn't been discovered, it hasn't been sorted out. But there's no difference in saying sudden unexplained infant death. There is no difference between that and undetermined after autopsy and toxicology studies. But if you say it's sudden unexplained infant death, people think of it as being benign. But if I say undetermined after autopsy and toxicology, then there's a question mark.
But here's the biggest question mark Batone has after studying the autopsy of baby Draco Ford.
What I really find appalling, though, is in that case, let me look at my documentation because I want to make sure it's accurate. The autopsy for the Ford baby is done on November 19th, 2019. But the final cause of death is not determined until March 15th, 2021. So this case stayed open for 16 months. So we have a child that died in November, and Children's Services is waiting to see if this is a safe home and waiting to see if this is accurate. And you can see right here on the doctor, it's called a Form 15, that the date of the autopsy is November 19th, 2019, and the final is 3/15/2021. How are we expecting law enforcement and Children's Services and the state, because this is a daycare home, there's community licensing, which is a state agency also involved. How are they expected to find out if this is a safe home when it's 16 months for the Department of Medical Examiner Coroner to come out with a cause of death for the first baby? That is, I don't have words for how disgusted I am at that.
Despite having no official cause of death for Draco, the first baby who died in the Palmdale foster home, until the spring of 2021, DCFS did not immediately remove other children from the home after the three-month-old baby died. Now, DCFS would not answer questions about any specific case. They're bound by privacy laws. But they did tell me that the following department procedure is followed. Quote, if there is no suspicion of abuse or neglect by the caregiver or someone in the placement, DCFS takes no further action. End quote. There is a process the social workers follow to determine if the death was accidental, including consulting with law enforcement. In Draco's case, it appears the social workers believed the cause of death to be SIDS and took no further action. Denise Bretone questions whether a SIDS death determination can happen that quickly, especially by non-trained experts. She sees two distinct possibilities that first need to be investigated. One is an unintentional death due to an unsafe sleep environment. So if the crib had soft toys or pillows, and a baby rolls over and his face buries in the pillow and then he cannot lift his head or turn back over, he suffocates. The other is intentional suffocation. Investigating how a child died is complex, Batone says.
Because children do not have injuries like adults do. They don't fight back. They don't have injuries. Medical conditions can be masked.
The safest route would have been to take the other foster children out of the home the day Draco Ford died until these questions could be answered by the medical examiner. Yet they were not removed that day in November 2019. And 2 months later, Joseph Chacon died under the care of the same foster family. Just how many children die in foster care is incredibly hard to know exactly. There are privacy laws, which DCFS cited when answering my numerous record requests. There are also different criteria used to report the deaths, which leads to different numbers. For example, in 2019, I was told there were 23 out-of-home fatalities. DCFS says out-of-home care is when a child lives with a relative, in a foster home, or in a group home. But the department separately reported only 13 out-of-home deaths between 2015 and 2020. Why the discrepancy? In an email, DCFS said, quote, the 23 fatalities and the 13 fatalities contain data extracted at different times and using different criteria. End quote. But what is documented on DCFS's website is stark. From 2015 to 2019, there were 94 child deaths at the hands of parents or caregivers. 3 out of 4 of those children were Black and Latino. Black children make up a full 44% of all the children dying. When I sat down with the director of DCFS, Bobby Cagle, I asked him about this deep disparity.
It is very concerning. I think it's partly a result of the fact that we have so many children in our system. So they're statistically more likely to show up in statistic-like child fatalities. But certainly it is very concerning that the majority of these kids that are involved in fatalities are Black and Hispanic. If we're not getting the kind of services to families, to the children, in order to avoid those kind of outcomes, that's the ultimate racism. And that's something that we've got to address. We have to really get more preventative services out there to keep kids from coming into our care at all, and hopefully to keep parents from having to go down the path of some of the really destructive behaviors that adults can get into.
DCFS does not provide preventative services to avoid families entering the system. Its mandate is to protect children who are at risk of or are being abused or neglected. And it's a social worker who often has to determine this. While I wasn't granted permission to talk to the social workers involved in Joseph Chacon or Draco Ford's cases to ask them why they thought it was necessary to remove these babies from their mothers or ask them about these babies' deaths, I was able to talk with Mary Nichols.
I am retired. I'm a former child services administrator at the Department of Children and Family Services in Los Angeles County. And I was working with DCFS, as it's known, for 28 years before I retired.
Mary Nichols knows the system well.
Social workers get a really bad rap that they somehow, on their own, the one little person going out and making a decision, and it's not the case. It's a systemic decision.
She points out that one social worker alone cannot decide to remove a child. They have to report to a supervisor who will help make the decision. Law enforcement will weigh in, and ultimately a judge is the one who orders the child to be placed in foster care. That's the systemic decision. It's too easy to just blame one biased social worker, she says, for removing a child, who more often will be Black or Latino.
Social workers are at a disadvantage. It's because we are damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we take a child from a parent who may have been a victim of domestic violence, maybe because we know some other pieces, maybe because the batterer is so dangerous that the children are at risk, even if the mother is appropriate but can't protect because of his dangerousness. If we take the child and the child dies, we are damned. If we leave the child and try to protect her and the batterer breaks through and kills the child, we're damned. We can't predict people's behavior, and yet society, media think, well, why did you do that? And can't you see how bad it was for that child? Well, all child abuse is bad. All decisions whether to keep a child in the home or remove them from the home are traumatic. There is no simple way here. And that's something that I don't think the media sometimes portrays enough, is that you cannot always make the proper decision.
Part of the difficulty in figuring out how potentially dangerous a domestic violence situation might be is that the parent who has experienced the battering is also afraid of the social worker.
If you go and talk to the mother, they're so afraid of you taking their kids that they will align with and minimize. One, second, they will align and minimize because they're terrified of retaliation. And they will align with the batterer and minimize because it's most dangerous for them at the time. And so what happens is it's very difficult for social workers to be able to assess in a clear way who's the primary aggressor. In the meantime, as we know, the batterer is justifying his behavior and blaming and tainting. So that type of child abuse evaluation and assessment is extremely difficult.
And there's another issue that makes a social worker's job extremely difficult.
This job cannot be done with large caseloads.
This is Bobby Cagle again, the head of DCFS.
During the Gabriel Fernandez case, I've heard reports of people having 60 to 80 cases on their caseload. I can tell you right now, that is impossible. I was a decent social worker. 25 cases stretched me to the max. to the extent that I would go home at night and couldn't sleep because I was worried about whether I was going to be able to get back to see the other children that I had concerns for. And that kind of thing in the long run really wears you out. It causes you to burn out in the job and therefore leave the profession oftentimes. And that's not a good thing either.
Cagle says since 2013, after the death of Gabriel Fernandez, the department has doubled the number of social workers hired from about 2,000 back then to 4,000 now. But more social workers have not lessened the numbers of Black and Latino children who are removed in LA. And there are many children of color dying in foster care. DCFS Director Bobby Cagle acknowledges all of this. He says he wants things to change. When I asked him if parents are treated more harshly, scrutinized more by the system than foster parents, he disagreed.
The foster parents go through a more rigorous check than most anybody else in our system. There are a number of safeguards that are built in through federal and state law, as well as our policy. It takes about 90 days of study in order to be able to approve a home. And it takes longer in some cases. You know, we do everything from fingerprinting the resource parents to look for prior criminal history.
A resource parent is what the system calls a foster parent. And Cagle is clear that not everyone is cut out to be a foster parent.
We do not accept everyone who applies, certainly. And I think this is on point to something that the general public doesn't understand sometimes. Removing a child from the home and placing them somewhere else is not a fail-safe. There are children that are harmed in foster care. It is a very small number. But that is also a concern for me as the director of a large system. First of all, we know that bringing children out of home is damaging to them psychologically. We also know that potentially we could be placing them with someone who could also place them in danger, even with the best efforts that we have.
So what about the racism in the system? The disproportionately high number of Black and Latino children being taken from their parents?
This is deeply ingrained. This is not something that's on the surface. We've had very diligent efforts, but we have never had resources in the department that are fully devoted to the issue. The other thing that I have not been able to find historically is where we set specific goals around cutting the number of African-American and Latino children coming into our system. So we are going to be putting out specific goals that we will measure and make public so that the public can hold us accountable on this.
Bobby Cagle has worked in child welfare for decades across multiple states. And the problem of much higher rates of Black and Latino and Native children being removed is not unique to Los Angeles. It happens in many child welfare systems across the country. This might be a good place to point out just how much the U.S. spends on child welfare each year. It's about $9.8 billion.
Now, there are 50 child welfare agencies in the country, and the funds to underwrite them are in the billions. It's not a one among them that's reputed to be working well.
This is Molly Tierney. She ran the Baltimore Child Welfare Agency for almost a decade. Here she's on a TEDx stage in 2014, where she gave a talk based on her experience. She tried very hard to reform the system from the inside. And by many measures, she succeeded as she managed to greatly reduce the number of children who came into the system. But Tierney also began to see the problems as endemic to the very system she was trying to reform.
Think about it. The only time the federal government pays me is when I take somebody's kid. And as soon as that kid's in foster care, they instantly become a commodity. And the industry starts to wrap around doctors, lawyers, judges, social workers, advocates, whole organizations. The industry is committed to this intervention, this taking other people's children, because that's what it needs to survive. And it's on autopilot. Now, it's going to do whatever it has to do to stay alive. And this industry, to stay alive, needs other people's children.
After years of doing this work, Tierney saw that the act of removing children was an intervention that happened way too late. She said the solution should start much earlier.
We could align ourselves with existing activities farther upriver that are disciplined about an ounce of prevention. We could find the earliest moment to intervene with the family long before they need a catastrophic intervention like putting their kid in foster care. So little kids not going to school are a great example. When a 16-year-old's not going to school, they're making a choice. When a 4-year-old's not going to school, they're telling you by not showing up that something's not quite right at home. And when we send someone to tap on those doors to talk to parents about the importance of going to school every day and to listen about what's actually happening in that household, we learn fascinating things. Untreated asthma, so fixable. Unstable housing, harder to fix, but it doesn't mean your kid can't go to school.
What Tierney proposed back in 2014 was essentially to take the billions of dollars invested in the foster care industry, as she calls it, and use it way earlier to build a better social safety net to support families so they don't falter. It's an idea that's gaining popularity among mothers, activists who are calling for an end to foster care. Women like Joyce McMillan.
Hi, my name is Joyce McMillan, and I would describe myself as a parent who's been mistreated by an abusive system that people hail as a system that protects children while doing the exact opposite of that.
Joyce McMillan lives in New York City.
The system mistreated me because they came in looking for reasons to separate my family and not reasons to support us.
Her life was irrevocably changed one day when Child Protective Services knocked on her door.
And so when they knocked on my door, I cooperated, thinking they would see me for who I was, for the parent that I was to my children. And it was just all a misunderstanding. But once they asked me to give them a urine sample, nothing else in my life mattered. And so my children were immediately removed, and I remained separated from my daughters for 2.5 years.
McMillan, who had on occasion used drugs recreationally, was deemed to be an unfit parent to her daughters. With them gone, her life spiraled into a deep hole, she says, and her stable middle-class life vanished. The fight to get her daughters back broke her.
We are trapped in shame the same way prisoners are trapped in a cage. It is a cage. Walking, living, and breathing with extreme shame is a cage. It prevents you from functioning properly.
When McMillan finally got her daughters back, it took them years to rebuild as a family. They were traumatized. They all experienced their own PTSD-like symptoms. But here's where Joyce McMillan's story takes a different turn. While trying to reconstitute her family, she began wondering if this was happening to others too.
And I realized that year, 2 children had been removed from downtown in Battery Park, while it was about 1,600 in Harlem. And that was in one area of Harlem.
Battery Park is a wealthy white area. Harlem is lower income. Black and Latino.
You're looking at statistics, you know, that make this comparison between Battery Park and Harlem. How did you understand that?
I understood it to be racist.
McMillan was outraged. She wanted to do something.
Freedom is something you take!
Freedom is something you take!
Taking inspiration from the demands of the Black Lives Matter movement to abolish the police, activists like McMillan are demanding an end to Child Protective Services and a complete rethinking of child welfare.
What would it look like if we instead supported the family who we said was not rising to a level that we wish they would rise to in caring for their child? If they didn't lack a coat, because instead of giving money to a foster parent, you bought a damn coat, or you bought a bag of groceries. Even if you had to do that consistently for a moment, it makes no sense to me that we would spend our resources to separate. Separation is not support. Surveillance is not support. And poverty is not neglect. But these are the things that they easily get twisted.
Delasia Taylor, Draco Ford's mother, wants answers and justice. She still has one child in the foster care system. But after Draco passed, social workers finally placed her remaining child with her own mother, the child's grandmother. A request that had been made and denied at the very first court hearing when her children were removed.
There is literally probably nothing more horrible than that feeling of your small and tiny baby being taken from you and you don't know where they're going. They're just taking them somewhere and telling you, like, oh, you can't know where they are. Like, or it was just, I don't know. I'm sorry.
How do you go on knowing so little?
It's really hard, and I think about it every day, but never really sure what to do about it. Like, yeah, I do want justice for my child because he was just an innocent baby.
Hi.
Mom, look at her.
Oh, wow, she's beautiful.
I made her.
You made her beautiful? You put nail polish on her?
Yeah.
Wow. How pretty. She's going to look like a princess?
Leah has finally had her daughter return to her care. She cherishes every moment. But she says not a day passes when the loss of Joseph doesn't well inside of her.
The last time I seen Joseph was when I had taken my daughter, and it was the last time both of us had seen him while he was alive. So I'm glad that she got a chance to see him before he passed, because they weren't just taken from me, they were taken from each other.
She finally reunited with her daughter after a judge closed her DCFS case, and she's rebuilding her family. But they all miss Joseph tremendously.
I feel like the least they can do is give me an answer. I feel like that's the least you can give any parent whose child passes is an answer. I just want an answer of how it happened, because you can't go the rest of your life not knowing how.
Do you want justice?
I do. I want to know how it happened. And I want to know why it happened. And based on how it happened, I do want there to be justice.
Let me see. I'm thirsty.
Okay. You can get a juice.
Hmm?
You can get a juice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mommy?
Yes? Do you want me to get it?
You can open it.
Of course. Missy?
With Joseph's death declared accidental and no charges brought against the foster mother or anyone, Leah decided to pursue a civil suit. She's actively looking for some measure of accountability. She wants someone to listen to her side of how the system treated her.
A lot of things need to change. Things need to change with how social workers interact with, how they interact with families and how they decide if a child gets taken away from their parent. I think things need to change with giving people resources before they take away a child.
Mommy?
What is it? Oh, your doctor coat? You're gonna be a doctor?
But if then, I can open the doctor back.
Oh, okay. Did you want me to help you open it, or are you gonna have Grandpa open it?
You open it.
Oh, okay.
Mommy's on this
coat.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stephens.
Thank
you. You're welcome.
The
This episode was produced by Deepa Fernandez with help from Victoria Estrada. It was edited by Marta Martinez and mixed by Julia Caruso and Elisheba Itub. Deepa is an early childhood reporting fellow at Pacific Oaks College, which is funded in part by First 5 LA. Fact-checking for this episode by Ben Kalin. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Julio Ricardo Varela. Special thanks to Lori Turk-Bichakchu and Beth Harous of the Kids Data Program, Richard Cohn of USC School of Social Work, Susan E. Seeger of UC Irvine School of Law, Neil Rossini, and Sylvie De Toledo. Our engineers include Stephanie LeBeau and Leah Shaw Dameron, with help from Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Maria Esquinca. Our intern is Oscar De Leon. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on your social media. I'll see you there. Bye.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. The Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.